Hello, everyone. It's nice to be back with you. I am here with Chris Giancarlo. Chris is senior counsel for Wilkie Farr & Gallagher. He is the former chairman of the CFTC, and he is the executive chairman of the Digital Dollar Project. Chris is a regulatory leading light. He is an advanced thinker in the space of financial regulation, cryptocurrency regulation, and I'm excited to have Chris here with me today. So thanks for being here, Chris. If we could, my first question is, when I think about a central bank digital currency, can you tell us a little bit about what that is? And I think one of the criticisms I think about a lot and hear a lot is that a CBDC is inherently a sort of surveillance project. So is that accurate? Is that reasonable to think about it that way? Or is there a different way of thinking about it?
So the short answer is it needs to be. However, you're quite right that I think somewhat unfortunately, that's become our default thinking about what CBDC is. So let's take that a little bit below. We also say it's delightful to be with you. It's terrific, and I've been looking forward to this interview. First of all, what is CBDC? CBDC is a digital currency system that, like cash money, enjoys the full faith and credit of a sovereign. You might think about the coming world of digital systems of value when it comes at least to instruments that have the indices of money, being that they're stores of value, that they're payment systems, and that they're means of measurements of account of value, which are the three traditional indices of what money is, that there are really two divisions, and then within one of those divisions, two further divisions. So you can divide them between centralized and decentralized. Decentralized a la Bitcoin or Ethereum, and then centralized like stablecoins, or centralized like central bank digital currency. The difference between stablecoins and central bank digital currency is that one enjoys the full faith and credit of a sovereign, and the other one is backed by instruments that enjoy the full faith and credit, but they are ultimately commercial obligations, not sovereign obligations. So divide the future forms of money into decentralized and centralized, and then for the centralized systems, sovereign and non-sovereign. CBDC would be the sovereign form. Stablecoins would be the non-sovereign form. We know about already the pseudonymity aspects of decentralized systems such as Bitcoin. We are concerned, however, about privacy issues in not just sovereign forms of digital money, but any type of centralized forms of digital money. To think that somehow privacy is inherently less protected in a sovereign system than in a commercially operated centralized system is kind of shallow thinking. There is nothing inherently more protected in any centralized system, whether it's centralized by a big tech company or centralized by a government. In fact, we've seen just in the last few years how big technology companies, whether they're Facebook or YouTube, have been only too happy to censor information that governments do not want discussed online. So to think that somehow when those same big tech companies or new big tech companies are centralizing systems of value, that they're not going to be a subject to a government pressure. You know, government will come around and say, okay, we've now got a new licensing regime for stablecoins, which, as you know, is moving through the House of Representatives. Nice license you got there, Mr. Stablecoin Operator, but we see you're allowing people to purchase ammunition with your stablecoin. We'll allow it could be a right-wing government saying that you're funding Planned Parenthood, or a left-wing government saying you're funding Right to Life. Well, we don't like that anymore. So unless you want to keep your license, you better stop allowing those transactions. You know, at least with an American CBDC, there is something called the Bill of Rights, which protects freedom of speech. And so one could argue, and this is all philosophical because we do not yet have a U.S. CBDC, but one could argue, I think quite plausibly, that a sovereign CBDC that is consistent with the Constitution would provide one with greater privacy rights that a stable coin, which is not subject, because private actors are not subject to the Bill of Rights, only governs government activities. But let's put that aside, for example, because you're quite right to note that I think a lot of public thinking right now defaults to, well, if the government's running it, it's going to be a surveillance tool. I met with a very well-known economist who you see on television constantly for lunch yesterday in Washington. And his knee-jerk reaction was, well, if the government does it, nothing's going to be private. And I, you know, said, well, what makes you think it's going to be private if it's run by? But what was clear to me is what a victory China's already had in central bank digital currency. They as your listeners probably know, China has unveiled and has been working on for almost a decade now something called their ECNY, which is the digital RMB. And they've already placed it in 260 million Chinese wallet holders. And that's a two-year-old figure. The real number is probably much greater than that. Just this week, China announced the very first international transaction for oil using the digital RMB. China is participating in pilot projects with other countries around the world, including the Middle East, for global payments in digital RMB. That RMB, so I had the great fortune to serve on a Hoover Institute study that did a one-year study of the digital RMB, which we delivered to the Biden White House. It's probably the most in-depth study out there. It's available on the Hoover Institute's website. Clearly, the digital RMB is a surveillance tool. And it's not only a surveillance tool, it's a censorship tool. If you criticize the regime, your digital RMB will be turned off from enabling you to get a train out of your village. And so it will have not only surveillance to know what you're using your money to do, but the ability to disable your money from doing things you want to do if you run afoul of the regime.
That, I think that's the fear that that's what will happen in the U.S., right? That if you have this CBDC, then you're going to create a system where that can happen, I guess.
So let me just take that for a second. So give China credit, because having established the benchmark, they've now got it in our heads that that's the form of CBDC. But you know as well as anybody, whenever you go from analog to digital, it's all the design elements. There's absolutely no reason why a U.S. CBDC or a European CBDC or British that's consistent with democratic principles could not have built into it as a design element inability to surveil, inability to censor, and make it operationally transparent so you don't need to have the government tell you you're not being surveilled. You can look for it yourself. The design would be operationally transparent that you can confirm for yourself. What's limiting our ability to get there right now is China's already gotten our head and established what a CBDC, at least their version, I call their version surveillance coin. But there's no reason why, and I'll go back to a historical example. The United States led the first wave of the Internet Information, and we insisted that it be open architecture and not subject to tyrannical regimes' insistence of control. Why are we not doing the same thing in this new wave of the internet and internet value, and insist that anything generated by a democratic society, whether it be a stable coin or whether it be a CBDC, whether it be a digital euro, American-based stablecoin based on the dollar, or someday maybe the digital dollar itself, all of those should be freedom from surveillance, freedom from censorship, and they can be. The technology is there. What's lacking right now, I think, is a lack of imagination, creativity, and certainty of our own value sets that made the original internet free for freedom-loving people. We need to make the future of money free for freedom-loving people.
So, you know, one of the I go to Davos every year for the World Economic Forum, and WEF gets a ton of criticism. And the criticism is this is the blob, the surveillance state that they want to jab everybody with a vaccine and control everyone's money and blah, blah. There's a lot of criticisms. Now, one of the things I've always thought to myself is why would a central bank digital currency be so different from a surveillance perspective than what we have now? Like, it's not hard to send a subpoena to Chase Bank or to Citibank, and it's not hard to control banks. They're regulated. This isn't a tough thing to do. The banks are monitoring transactions anyways for KYC purposes. So I never quite understood why that is such a difference, other than it's just bad marketing. And I guess who in your mind is responsible for that marketing? Like, who will take that message to the American people and say, here's what this is, here's why it's not as bad as what you think, here's why it's a good thing for American society?
That's a great question, Lee. You know, we launched the Digital Dollar Project actually at the World Economic Forum in the year 2020. And we basically set our mission in very simple terms, which has remained our mission today. And that is, how do we future-proof the dollar? How do we enhance, if not preserve, its reserve currency status? And how do we do so that is consistent with democratic values, including right to economic privacy, in a world where value is increasingly moving onto, as we said at the beginning, both decentralized and centralized systems of value, some of which have very strong commercial interests to want to market that data and develop that data, and governments have ability to want to surveil that data. And so that's what the task we set out for the Digital Dollar Project. Now, we hope to carry the banner that, first of all, we start from the premise that, and not maybe everyone doesn't agree with this, but I feel that the dollar's role as a reserve currency, on balance, has been a net good, not just for Americans, but for humanity. I don't think the last 40 years of globalization, in which more people have risen out of poverty than ever before in human history, would have taken place without the dollar as a stable store of value and payment system around the globe. So therefore, I think that preserving that is a net good. And yet, we are going into a future where value is increasingly going to move off of the balance sheets of proprietary commercial institutions, which is where 90% of value sits today, onto internet-based systems of value. Some of those decentralized, like Bitcoin, Ethereum, others centralized by governments, like a digital euro, and others centralized by stablecoin operators. So how do we preserve the dollar's value in that future? That future is coming. Just a couple of facts for your audience. Over 130 countries today are looking at central bank digital currency, with 50 of them in advanced stages. In addition to China, Europe has now gone into their two-year implementation phase for a digital euro. Britain has said they will make a decision on a digital pound by the end of the decade. The IMF has said that by the end of the decade, we'll have 15 retail central bank digital currency operations in the world and 9 wholesale. So CBDC is coming, whether Americans want it or not, and whether we have governors of southern states saying they're going to ban it. It's coming.
There's an element, I guess, of you might as well get on board with this and figure out how to do it our way, because otherwise it's going to happen some other kind of way.
Exactly. And look, and stablecoins are coming too. And I'm a big supporter of stablecoin development. I think that's the traditional American way of going about developing new technologies, right? It's a public-private. But the same, we need to have the same skepticism about stablecoin operations of money as we do about government operation of money. There is, if you look at the terms of privacy, they're not terribly great. There is nothing to stop government licensing entities from telling stablecoin operators what information they've got to turn over to the government. And there's nothing to stop those stablecoin operators from turning that information over for commercial purposes as well. So a digital future of value is coming. It's time to get the values right in what that looks like. And I think this is where democratic societies are not active on the global stage. Right now, China is at every one of those international conclaves working on interoperability standards. And they are insisting upon an internet of value that is safe for surveillance and is safe for censorship.
Right. I mean, this is sort of a part of the Belt and Road Initiative and expanding China's influence and soft power around the world. I guess the next question I would ask then is, you know, there's an idea that is circulating through a lot of Bitcoin fans, and that is that fractional reserve banking is somehow inherently dangerous. I would probably take the opposite side of that and say that fractional reserve banking is one of the greatest technological innovations and drivers of economic growth in American society for decades. But I think it's gotten a bad rap, and there is a perception that fractional reserve banking is dangerous. Can you talk a bit about how a CBDC would work in and how that would relate to the idea of fractional reserve banking? And then specifically, one question I'm trying to get to is, I think that there's a perception that fully reserved banking is inherently a right-wing idea, and that fractional reserve banking is somehow more left-wing. Do you think that's the am I perceiving that the right way? Is that the right way to think about this?
Well, so what's interesting, Lee, is that it's a question we're asking as we're moving into a new internet-based system of digital networks of value. We're asking the question of, what is the role of fractional banking in that new future? How is it affected? Is it disrupted by this? The fact of the matter is, we haven't done enough testing to really know the answers. I can make as equally a theoretical argument that it's not changed simply because the economics on the ground haven't changed. Somebody that's got $10,000 that wants to buy a $40,000 car still needs to borrow it from somewhere. Their digital currency is not going to solve that problem for it, right? Someone who's got a loaded digital currency that's not paying interest, that wants to keep that on their mobile device, is no different than somebody's grandfather who keeps stacks of $100 bills under their mattress. It's not a prudent long-term strategy. There will be those people, but I think they'll be just as, if not, I think it'll be the majority of people that are saying, let me put most of my digital money in a fractional bank to get some interest on it. And those who, so I don't think, I theoretically speaking, that fractional banking is affected by a movement. I do think other parts of banking, like correspondent banking, are affected. I'll turn to that in a second. But I do want to point to the Europeans. You know, the European economy is not as market-based and market-based finance as is the American economy. It's much more based on bank-based finance. I don't think Europe would be barreling ahead to developing a digital euro if they believed that a digital euro is going to disrupt the banking sector that drives the whole European economy. Now, I haven't seen the data on which they base it. That's going to be an important experiment for us that are interested in the digital future of money as to whether developing a CBDC. But if it doesn't pay interest, theoretically at least, but we need to test this out because this reality is coming, as you say. I do want to turn to correspondent banking, however. What is correspondent banking? That's the bank's role in moving money around the globe. It's estimated that it takes 1% to 2% of the world's GDP just to move money around the globe. Why is that? Because the way money moves around the globe, it moves from bank account to bank account, and all of the identification, all of the KYC, all of the AML that goes into that process makes it slow, it makes it expensive, and it actually makes it fairly exclusive, because if you don't have sufficient credentialed ID, you can't access that system. That is going to be, it's already being disrupted by the speed and immediacy by which stablecoins are moving money around the globe. And I think CBDC, and China is experimenting this with their. So I think the correspondent banking business, this new version of the internet, has set its rifle sights on in the same way that, you know, the internet set its rifle sights on postal mail, right? How often do people write letters today to communicate? They just send an email, right? And we've lived through that transition and accepted it. I think, quite frankly, the movement of money around the globe is going to go to an internet basis, and that is going to change correspondent banking. But it'll be a gradual change, but it will be a change that I think is inevitable. Fractional banking, however, I think there's a very plausible argument that's not affected by this. And we've got a grand experiment on the horizon with the digital euro, and we'll see how that works out.
So you think fractional banking can coexist just fine in a CBDC era? Can we shift topics slightly? You were the chairman of the CFTC. Commodities, I would imagine, are certainly well within your purview. There was something interesting and exciting that happened last year in the nickel market in Europe that I thought was fascinating. I wrote about it at the time, talked about it at the time. I'd love your take, if you are comfortable with it, on how you would handle what happened in the nickel market and the LME last year. I'm not looking for like criticism of the LME so much as just like what's the right approach to problems like that and to managing the idea of counterparty risk.
Right. So I have no particular inside knowledge. I wasn't at the CFTC. My term had ended before that crisis took place, and I don't have. I only know what I've read. However, I have been and was at the time and remain today a critic of UK government policy that allowed the LME to be sold to its ultimate Chinese buyers. While there's no question that markets in China have grown in international stature over the last two decades, they still are evidently subject to government pressured activity.
Yeah, I mean, it's like heavy-handedness, right? This guy is our favored buddy, so we're going to make a free market not so free to favor that guy.
They call it the home team. You know, it is not good for the Chinese regime if markets go down. So when there's markets going down, they call the home team to buy. And the Chinese banks and financial institutions step up. It does look, from what I've read, that in the case of that LME crisis, there was a large Chinese-backed market participant who may have gotten in some trouble. And so there was extraordinary selling pressure in the market. And there was, I think, a combination of natural non-political market actors and yet some politically influenced actors pressuring back and forth against each other. I'm not in a position to criticize the LME's decision to pause, but it was fairly unprecedented. It does not speak well for market certainty going forward that decisions like that will not be politicized in the future. So I think LME, unfortunately, undermined its integrity as a neutral marketplace. And I have read reports that a lot of that activity is actually moving away now from LME to other markets here in the United States. And so they undermine their own credibility. Markets have to operate with market neutrality. And I think that's one of the reasons why U.S. markets have been so successful. And if I can jump ahead to one of the things I did when I was at the CFTC, it's well known that we greenlighted the first Bitcoin futures product, and there's a lot of reasons why we did that, and was some controversy at the time. But one of the drivers in that is it was very important to me to make sure that the price of Bitcoin was set in dollars. Most of the world's key commodities are priced in dollars, and that's been one of the underpinnings of the U.S. dollar as a reserve currency. And although it was certainly trending in that direction, most commodities are not priced in the spot commodity markets. They're priced in the futures market, because it's in the futures market where all the buyers and sellers come together. That's true about every major commodity, oil and everything. So as important as the spot market is for many traders in Bitcoin right now, the fact of the matter is the price is set in the futures market. And today the price is set in dollars. About 25% of the futures activity takes place on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, regulated by the CFTC. That percentage has gone up, and I imagine that percentage will continue to go up. And I think that's an enhancement for the dollar as a reserve currency as we go into a new digital future of money.
So if I were to think about that, I mean, look, I'm a believer that the dollar is not really at risk in a meaningful way of losing its status as the world's reserve currency. I think it's very easy for the press to get kind of overbreathed about this and just, you know, the it's coming. It's going to be bad. I don't see a meaningful alternative. So when I read something that says, you know, the dollar is losing its status, we've debased the dollar, and like, yes, but like every currency has been debased, and I don't think we're really at risk of that. That's just personal opinion on this. I do, however, think we have, you know, in meaningful ways degraded the value of the dollar. It just so happens that everyone else degraded their own currencies at the same time, and so we're still good. I think that's a really interesting point you raised about pricing Bitcoin futures in dollars. There's obviously some very interesting stuff going on right now in terms of approval or not of certain Bitcoin trading products that are based on the Bitcoin price. And there's a lot going on in this space. So let me ask a question that I asked to Jennifer Shulp when I interviewed her, which is, if I think about Bitcoin and Ethereum and I contrast those with other cryptocurrencies that are out there, I think there's a perception that some pass the Howey test, some do not pass the Howey test. How would you think about that? And what is kind of the threshold for what makes a security at this point? What makes one of these cryptocurrencies legit versus sort of a broader currency, like a corporate thing versus a currency? How would you think about that?
I want to answer that question, but Lee, but I actually want to Do you want to just finish off the conversation of the dollar as a reserve currency and what's the threats to it? Usually dominance in any given area of human activity often ends with the technological change. You know, Catholic Church dominance of medieval Europe ended with the printing press, right? And the resulting Reformation, and either war or technological change. As we see the world gradually move from systems of value that are based upon the balance sheets of financial institutions to systems of value that are based upon the internet, the dollar, as strong as it is and as lack of relative competition in today's world to it, does need to move with the times. Lael Brainard, NEC director, former governor of the Federal Reserve, has said she can't get her head around the notion of in a digital world, the dollar remaining analog. And I have to say, I agree with that. We can't rest on our laurels. And the dollar still fights off all comers in the market. You know, serving reserve currency is a relative proposition. So somebody's got to beat you at that. But if you look at history, currencies that have been dominant have often had technological superiority over the others. The reason why the dollar is called the dollar is it took the name from what had been the dominant currency during the cross-Atlantic discovery of the Western Hemisphere, and that was the Spanish dollar. And the Spanish dollar was considered the superior currency because it was minted in such a way that it could be broken into eight equal pieces called pieces of eight, making it more fractional. You know, in a digital future, if the dollar remains analog, that is, I think, going to be one of those technological innovations that if we don't make, could give another currency a leg up. And certainly Europe is thinking about that as they design a digital euro. And, you know, stablecoin operators should be thinking about that as well. If there's a run on a stablecoin, if the only sovereign digital currency you can go to is the euro, that's where it's going to go. In the same way that, you know, you put your money in the bank, but you know you can run down to the ATM if there's a run. If there's a run on a stablecoin, I guess you can go to another stablecoin, but if there's a run on all stablecoins, there's no digital dollar, your alternative is going to other digital currency. So I do think the United States needs to think about modernizing the future. Now let's talk about this legendary distinction between digital commodities and digital securities turning on the Howey test. The way my simple mind thinks about it, and the way I thought about it when we were at the CFTC, the way we thought about it when the CFTC declared in 2015 that Bitcoin was under the CFTC's jurisdiction as a commodity and not a security, is it comes down to the basic role of the two agencies. The SEC oversees markets for capital formation. Somebody's got capital looking to attract investors, or somebody looking to invest that capital in something that will give them a good return. It could be a debt return. It can be an equity return. in those marketplaces overseen by the SEC, they find those opportunities. Or someone with an opportunity, they see an opportunity to build a new business, but they need capital. In markets overseen by the SEC, they find those investors, and they'll often issue debt, they'll sell securities. But the purpose of the debt and securities is to fund an enterprise. It's about an investment market. That's not what the CFTC does. The CFTC sees markets for risk transfer. Someone who's got the risk of the price of a commodity rising or falling. Somebody who's got the risk of an interest rate or an exchange rate or a rising and falling will find someone who's willing to bear that risk in return for a fee. So the CFTC oversees markets for risk transfer. The SEC oversees markets for investment and capital formation. When one looks at crypto, I think the easy way to do this is to say, what is the purpose of this crypto here? Is it to fund an enterprise? And if it is, then the SEC, in our system of civilized, organized government, we have commonly, as a society, declared there should be regulation of the activity. And it's not
because something is like a unique form of equity, you're saying. Like some of these are synthetic equity in a way.
That's exactly right. I think that certainly we saw it during the ICO boom, and we see it today, that in a sense, the investment of the token is made to further an enterprise. And in that case, there is a legitimate role for the SEC. Now, whether the SEC has put together a framework for this new technology that can work in it, because look, the SEC has numerous frameworks. There's no one securities framework. A municipal security has a different framework in the SEC than does a private placement security, as does, you know, there's probably more than a dozen different frameworks, the SEC, because of the different instruments. And so what's missing here is a framework for digital securities. On the other hand, in markets where the underlying instrument is commodity-like, which Bitcoin and Ethereum are, they're not used to fund an enterprise. There is no enterprise behind them. Then that's appropriate for CFTC regulation. CFTC regulation is quite different than SEC. For example, there is no prospectus for a commodity future or a derivative on a commodity in the CFTC. And so it's a different framework, but it's one that I think has been applied quite successfully. We've now had Bitcoin futures for 5 years, and that market is deep, it's liquid, it's transparent, it's orderly, and it's well-regulated. So I think that CFT has shown its ability to identify correctly. By the way, the determination that Bitcoin is a commodity has been upheld by federal court. So I think it's shown its ability to, and by the way, under both Democrats and Republicans. So although I was at the commission, I was not chairman then. Tim Massin, a Democrat, was chair when the determination was made that Bitcoin is a commodity. And yet it was a Republican me who greenlighted Bitcoin futures, and then my successor, Heath Tarbert, who greenlighted Ethereum futures. So the ability to both designate and regulate digital commodities has been successful under both Republican and Democrat leadership of the CFTC in a way that's quite consistent. So I think it's actually quite a remarkable track record of success, and one where the United States actually has led the world. Because at the time we greenlighted Bitcoin futures in 2017, no other major economy had done that. Now, I don't think we've kept that progress going as well, but we certainly have a lot to be proud of for the early stages of this.
You know, you raise an interesting question, which is this sort of dynamic between the SEC versus the CFTC. Can you talk a little bit about the inside baseball between those regulatory agencies? Is there a sort of competition? Is there a kind of land grab when new markets come into being? And then last, and I'm going to ask this question in a slightly pejorative tone, but I've seen certainly what I perceive in other government agencies as they become almost like jobs programs where they exist to write rules that create more need for regulators and regulation, because that just increases the power of the agency and the power of the people running the agency. Do you think that is a valid way to think about either of these agencies and what how they're acting?
So let's start with the issue of rivalry between the agencies. You know, our American founders had a very sort of heterodox notion, and that is the only way to keep government from usurping the freedoms of the citizenry was to keep government in competition with itself. And they created three co-equal branches of government and set them in motion to continually compete with each other. Well, it wasn't just at that level, at the federal level. They also have state and federal jockeying for position. And we've carried that through in building a regulatory state. We don't have one market federal regulating United States. We have two, where most of the world has one. We don't have one banking regulator. We have three in Washington, whereas most of the world has one. So this uniquely American approach to regulation both is maybe in some ways the worst and the best of all systems. I would say that in many ways it's actually operated quite well. So just let's take Bitcoin futures. I'm not sure there would be regulated Bitcoin futures if there was one single regulator in Washington and it wasn't the CFTC making that determination. You know, CFTC launched Lab CFTC to get its head around this new innovation in 2017. Well, what did the SEC do in 2018? They launched their FinHub. So sometimes a little bit of rivalry is not a bad thing to spur innovation. And I think in the case of the CFTC, I did an analysis of this when I was at the commission, and it's in one of my speeches. Between the year 2000 and 2018, the CFTC greenlighted more new financial products than almost all the world's other financial market regulators combined.
So does that imply that the CFTC is just a more effective and more productive regulator? And if so, my perception as a complete outsider, my perception is that the CFT is sort of losing the tug of war a little bit at this point and is starting to play more of a backseat role. You would think it would be the opposite because the CFTC, it seems, has been so successful. What gives there? Am I thinking about it the wrong way?
So, you know, you asked for the inside baseball. Yeah. You know, you have to look at the oversight out of Congress. The CFTC is overseen by the ad committees. The SEC is overseen by the banking committees. The banking committees are very powerful committees with very powerful constituents. And so the SEC has important benefactors. What I would say is, though, there's strength in specialization. If you just take the two cryptos that the CFTC oversees, you're looking at 70%+ of the trading market. You're looking at, or perhaps even more, you're looking at, you know, by evaluation size. So the CFTC has not bitten off more than it can chew, but I think it chews quite well what it has bitten off. And notwithstanding the tug of war and the, you know, the more 24/7 news feed out of the SEC, the CFTC is the quiet engine that continues to chug along. So I think, you know, our system has worked well here. I do think there's other issues that are holding up the development promulgation of a bespoke regulatory regime for crypto at the SEC. I think we have different issues at stake. I think that, first of all, we've got a generational divide. You know, the generation that's in charge of a lot of our financial market regulation, not just in the United States, but globally, as well as in our political system, is a generation that grew up before the digitally networked world. It's a generation that today calls their grandkids and says, how do I download this new app to my mobile device? And yet we're asking them to deal with digital systems of value, AI, and ultimately quantum computing, right? We'll get a new generation in the next few years entering into these roles simply because the older generation will time out. And this new generation inherently understands digital networks. So that's
we've all seen the congressional hearings where there's, you know, a congressperson who will ask the dumbest possible question that shows they have absolutely no idea what's going on, right? It's, I mean, as you said, my grandfather used to say, tell me, what is this internet? And it's the same the same kind of energy as that.
Yeah. You know, Doug Adams, author of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, has a great quote that I'll paraphrase because I can't remember it exactly, but he says, anything that's invented before you turn 35 is just part of the natural order of the universe and is probably where you're going to make your career. But anything that's invented after you turn 35 is dangerous, suspect, and needs to be suppressed. And I think we've got that desire to suppress this innovation. It challenges everything they know about finance in many ways.
And in a way, that's conservatism, right? The idea of like not having change and maintaining the old way of doing things versus accepting the new and innovative way. That's conservatism in a sense.
It's conflating financial stability with defending the status quo. That somehow holding on to the status quo preserves financial stability. And yet history tells you, if you hold on to the status quo, events and technology will overwhelm it and you'll actually get the instability that you're afraid of. But there's another fundamental divide going on that I think informs the whole crypto debate. And that is from the period, and I'll admit my own bias, the period I came into public life in the mid-1980s until at least the early 2000s, there was a dominant philosophy about finance that said the market, albeit imperfect, is the best way to allocate capital and financial resources. That is yielding to a different philosophy that says that market has actually failed to get capital resources to many communities that have been underrepresented in this. And therefore, the solution is to bring a political component. Political representatives and regulatory agencies need to actually affirmatively nudge capital in this direction or that direction. I think both of those philosophies are fighting a rearguard action against a technology that says, wait a minute, it's going to be the algorithm that's going to determine how this is allocated. And I think for those who are believe in the old market-based approach, but especially those who want a political input, this algorithm-based approach is actually very threatening to them. So I think what you hear from the left is opposition to this technology because it takes away their ability to direct capital in one direction or another, or at least their aspiration to do that. And I think with those old market-based people, it's just, well, let's just let the market do it. In fact, that I began the conversation by talking about a recent conversation. I said, you know, when it comes to development of digital money, just let the market do it. Well, we've seen how the market can be manipulated by government powers, as it was with freedom of speech in media. So I'm a big believer in this technology because of that very notion that if we design it right, which is why I don't quite understand those who say CBDC is inherently, as we began the conversation, dangerous to freedom of speech because it's all about the algorithm. We can design digital systems of value which have the full faith and credit of the government, but which are not subject to individual surveillance and limitation and censorship of economic activity. It's all about the design. Let's get the design right. We got the design right of the first wave of the internet. Why wouldn't we instead, that was an open internet that was not subject to tyrannical rule. Why would we not take the same approach to the digital future of money? Whether they're run by big tech or governments, we need to make sure that it's an open system that protects our privacy and prevents us from being surveilled and censored.
I mean, I think we have the Bill of Rights, which is all about creating the balance of power between government and the individual. And so then it comes down to, can you use the guarantees in that Bill of Rights and extend that in a way that allows a CBDC to not impinge on the freedom of the individual and to create more power in the hands of government and government regulators, right? I mean, that there is a power struggle, of course, that always happens, right?
And there's nothing in that's incompatible with law enforcement. It's just that law enforcement needs to move away from a system that says, we want your identity before you do that financial transaction in case you do something illegal, to a system that we're already very familiar with, and it's been enshrined in democratic systems for at least 800 years, that notion that you actually enjoy a degree of privacy unless there's probable cause that you did something illegal, in which case law enforcement has certain controlled rights to gain your information. And you know, it's exactly what we do every day on highway law enforcement. You don't stop at the toll booth and say, here's my driver's license in case I do something wrong in the next 50 miles. you freely access the freeway, and then law enforcement uses observation to look for indices of wrongdoing, speeding, reckless driving, in which case they then interdict that activity, they stop the activity, and what do they do last? They get your identity last. And so we can go to a system. In fact, it's done every day. If my credit card is used at a gas pump to put gas in my car, and 5 minutes later it's buying five computers on Amazon, I get a call from the credit card company, right? So there's no reason why government can't move to an activities-based observation, become a node on the blockchain, observe activity pseudonymously, and only when there's probable cause can they unmask. We need to use privacy-enhancing technologies, zero-knowledge proof, other technologies, to go to a system where value is stored on the internet, who owns what and who's transferring what to whom, is private activity unless there's indices that show probable cause of wrongdoing, which we can establish through big data analysis, AI tools, and the like. So we can do this. You know, the technology exists, the mind power to do this. We've just got to stop allowing ourselves to fall in simple assumptions that China's already won the debate and that their benchmark is going to be the benchmark, and that somehow, if it's done by the private sector, all's going to be well. We can give them all our data and they're going to keep it safe and not turn it over for their own commercial purposes or for government. That's a false assumption. We need to be much more active in thinking about future-proofing the dollar, preserving its reserve currency status, and the values on which it stands in anything that uses the dollar. If it's a stable coin tied to the dollar, the same obligations of privacy must apply as to whether it's a government developed digital dollar.
Have you studied the idea of homomorphic encryption at all? And have you thought about how that is essential or not essential to the use and implementation of a CBDC?
I think it's essential. So I just published a paper early this week, that would be the last week in October, in Central Banking Magazine, along with Daniel Gorfine, who is my chief innovation officer at the CFTC and is a co-founder of the Digital Dollar Project, on the role of the private sector in developing digital money. And in that article, we argue that if we're going to stand up for our values, we must insist that government adopt technologies like homomorphic encryption and privacy, other privacy protecting technologies, and get out of the trajectory we're on right now, which you mentioned earlier, that in our existing analog banking system, we've already violated our constitution time and time. Banks are not just gathering for AML, KYC. They're handing over reams of data to government agencies all the time for surveillance purposes. For those who say, why get rid of cash? We enjoy privacy today. We don't enjoy privacy today. We, you know, since the Bank Secrecy Act, certainly since 9/11, we've gone to a much more wholesale surveillance system of government oversight of our activities. And in fact, in another article I did with Jim Harper of American Enterprise Institute, published by the American Enterprise Institute earlier this year, we argue that the existing system is actually terrible, constitutionally speaking, and we should use this moment in time when we're moving to digital systems to reassess all of our constitutional principles in the new digital money. In fact, we should use this moment in time to reset. We need almost a popular uprising of free citizens to say to the government, we've already gone too far. Let's go to a digital system of money where we can operationally know for ourselves that we're not being surveilled. Or if you are, that it's constitutionally legitimate based upon longstanding principles of probable cause. People should be able to establish for themselves that government can only surveil them if there's a reason and can take them to court if there's not. We've lost that because we don't actually see all the surveillance that's going on.
There's a lot of criticism of Bitcoin because of its environmental impact or perceived environmental impact, the amount of electricity used for proof of stake. I actually come at it a slightly different way. I'm curious your thoughts on this. I imagine a sort of a solar farm in the desert in Texas or New Mexico or somewhere where sunshine is abundant, land is close to free. And I imagine the idea of setting up a Bitcoin mine that's powered by solar energy that would otherwise be lost, and that allows you to capture the value of that energy and then to move it instantaneously somewhere else. And so in my mind, other than as a method of payment, I think of Bitcoin as a store of value of electricity, and that may be one of the best use cases for Bitcoin. Is that something you've thought about? Is that a topic you've considered? Do you think that makes sense?
Look, all human activity requires energy. It uses a lot of energy to operate branch banks around the country. It requires a lot of energy to keep ATM machines running all night long, 24/7 around the country. All human activity, the existing banking system, utilizes a huge amount of energy and devours a huge amount of gross domestic product. All of that verification of identity that goes into that requires huge processing power. So a holistic analysis on a relative basis of a digital system compared to our current analog system, we use analog and digital a little bit, I think, too freely. What we're talking about, I mean, the existing system is digital, but it's not digitally networked. What's really revolutionary here is the notion of networking the data, whether it be through distributed ledger technology or otherwise. But, you know, taking out the correspondent banking that we talk section others, there's no reason why this new innovation could not be net equal or better than the old system. And that's the way I think we need to think about it, as opposed to just saying, well, mining uses a lot of power, without admitting that, well, ATM machines use a lot of power. What's the relative ratio? The Chamber of Digital Commerce in Washington has done some very good analysis of this power complaint about Bitcoin and shown it to be less of a threat to our global planet than I think those advocates or those adversaries of Bitcoin would have it be. And yet, at the same time, we know that when you net go from analog systems to digital systems, you often have a net decrease in power usage. And so I think these concerns need to be tended to, they need to be addressed, but they cannot be a basis to say, therefore, let us not move forward with this innovation as a society. We didn't do that with the first wave of the internet. We shouldn't do it with this wave of the internet. And just by doing it, we're not going to shut the world down. The rest of the world's going to move forward, and all it's going to mean is we're going to be left behind.
I take a seminar ongoing for a few years now with an economist, an author named Arnold Kling. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he was MIT trained in the 70s and 80s. One of the topics that we've talked about, or one of the things that he's written about, is if you look at electric cars now, and not just electric cars, I should say self-driving cars, autonomous vehicles, and you look at the safety record, which is somehow being criticized quite a bit, even though they are far safer than human-driven cars. One of the points that Arnold has made is if what we had right now was a world with all autonomous vehicles, and you proposed, hey, I want to have human-driven vehicles, I want those to become the new standard, would we as a society allow that compared to autonomous vehicles? And the answer is absolutely, positively not. Far, far more dangerous to have people behind the wheel. And I guess there's probably an analogy here, which is, if we had the current system was central bank digital currencies, would we even contemplate the idea of what you call the analog or the legacy system? And my instinct is the answer is absolutely NFW. No chance we would consider that. Is that right?
That's a great way of looking at it. That's a great way of looking at it. You know, I sometimes, I get to how many conversations I'm in with folks, they're saying, You know, should we or should we not have CBDC? Should we or should we not have crypto, right? As if a few people in some ivory tower at a university or in some government institution can like King Canute, say, I command the shore not to rise, right? I mean, this is coming. There's not anything any one of us or collectively all of us can do to stop a technological innovation, right? We couldn't stop the first wave of the internet. We're not going to stop this. What we've got to be asking ourselves is, how do we control? Control is probably beyond our power too. How do we influence it? You know, we were successful as an American society in influencing the first wave of the internet to insist that it be open and free and not subject to the ability of autocrats to control access to it. I'm not sure we fully won that battle, but that certainly was our position in it. Somehow we don't seem to be showing up at this at the debate over this next wave. We're sitting back saying, well, should we allow it to happen? There was an article that was entitled "To CBDC or Not to CBDC," as if Americans are going to change that trajectory. It's coming. We're going to have a digital euro. And by the way, to my friends in Florida where the government's seeking to ban it, you know, when the Miami Ferrari dealership goes to pay for their inventory, they're going to be paying in digital euros. There's no way to avoid this innovation. And stablecoins are coming as well. And we need to be asking more questions about both. We need to be influencing this consistent with our values, as opposed to throwing our hands up saying, well, we won't have CBDC, we'll just let the private sector do what they want. And no, I think we as a society, look, we talk about these constitutional rights, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of religion. In a capitalist society, those freedoms are nothing but how we spend our money, right? Freedom of speech is what publications do we read? Freedom of assembly is what organizations do we pay dues to? Freedom of religion is what churches and synagogues do we tithe to, right? Privacy is about, you know, our not just privacy of our identity, but privacy of our papers and effects and things. If we don't get these values encoded in the digital future of money, we will have lost those freedoms. And just simply saying no to CBDC is not going to cut it, because there's nothing protecting stablecoin operators from doing exactly what we're afraid of happening in CBDC. And I'm not criticizing the very fine stablecoin operators like Circle and PayPal out there that are doing some very, very good work. This is a values issue. And I think we as a free people need to speak up on this debate and say any type of digital form of money must be based upon democratic principles and our constitutional rights of privacy, rights of freedom of expression, freedom from government surveillance and censorship, consistent with our longstanding traditions of law enforcement based on probable cause. We can do this. We just need to move beyond sort of very simplistic, I think, unfortunately, shallow notions that China's already won the game and any type of government digital currency is going to be a surveillance tool. No, it's not. We're Americans. Let's influence this and make sure it's not the case.
I think this echoes a little bit in a sort of like Blockbuster versus Netflix case study, if you will, right? Where a business was afraid to cannibalize their own business and the risk of cannibalizing their own business. And then as a result, someone else just ate their lunch. And you sometimes have to be willing to cannibalize your own business, because if you don't do it, someone else will. And I think you could probably, that echoes here in the idea of we have to be willing to cannibalize parts of our own financial plumbing, because if we don't do it, someone else will do it for us.
Lee, you're absolutely right. To some degree, Americans' ambivalence toward this innovation is fully understandable. Because if you think about the latter half of the 20th century, when it came to finance, American institutions are king of the hill. Our currency is the world's reserve. Our banks dominant around the globe and dominant in moving money around the globe. Our foreign policy based upon sanctions ability, you know, unassailable for a long time. And finally, our form of regulation, entity-based regulation, regulate the intermediaries in the ecosystem, and that's how we do regulation. All of those systems dominated the late 20th century. The problem is this technology disrupts all of them. And because of that, some in power, and I think an older generation that grew up in that old dollar-based system, are saying, just say no to the innovation. suppress it, but you can't suppress it. And ultimately, I think a younger generation is going to come onto the scene that's saying, we can't suppress this. And our economic adversaries and economic competitors are moving forward. We need to get in the game. My worry is that by then, our economic adversaries have already made the system safe for their values of surveillance and censorship. We need to get in the game now and make sure this new innovation is built around our values of economic liberty, economic privacy, financial independence.
You know, Tyler Cowen made an offhand remark earlier this year in one of his pieces about the idea of crypto, that the best use case for crypto would be as a currency for artificial intelligence. And the idea he presented was, imagine that AI continues to progress, maybe not today, but say a year or 2 years from now, such that there are AI-based agents that can act independently and they don't need your approval to enter into commercial transactions. I think in the current system of KYC, it will be very difficult for a bank to say, yes, we will open an account for a chatbot that is its own independent entity that exists in some sort of, whether it's an LLC or corporation or something, where there's no one else on the hook. And then what happens when this chatbot does something and gets sued and there's no person to say, oh, you're the owner, you're actually financially on the hook? And so if the chatbot remains unbanked but needs to conduct commerce, the natural direction for it will be, hey, why not use Ethereum as the medium of exchange between one chatbot and another that are entering into a commercial transaction? Which, number one, when I read that idea, the kind of brain exploding emoji was happening. It was like, wow, what a great point. That makes so much sense. I'm curious if that's something you've ever thought about, what you think about that idea. Is that feasible, and what could that look like?
That is so interesting. I hadn't read that piece, but I'm a big fan of Tyler, and we're going to go read it. What it brings me to is something we haven't yet discussed, but it underlines so much of this new future that we're going into of digital systems of value, and that is identity. Identity in an analog world has always been very clear because nature has given us all such different physiologies, whether it's our fingerprints or our eye scans or just the way we look. And the human being has an amazing ability to recognize one face from another. So nature in an analog world has solved a lot of identity issues. But in a digital world, we're really on the precipice of trying to figure out what identity means. And it's particularly hard for us in democracies. And it's particularly hard for, especially hard for us in the United States, where we've long fought against the digital identity system because of legitimate privacy concerns. I think we are going to have to come up with a digital identity system that's consistent with our values, but allows for innovation in financial transactions in a digital world. And it's even before we get the chatbots, if you believe you're transacting with me electronically, how do you know you're transacting with me electronically, right? And to the extent KYC has been abused in an analog world, how do we apply it where it's appropriate to be applied in a digital world and do so safely? So we haven't begun to work that, and it's going to be some very hard conversations we're going to have in the United States. But I think might have to see a crisis or two before we really address that, hopefully we address that in a way that's not in a crisis, but we learn from a crisis why we need to do this in a very thoughtful way. And there's some very good people. Jim Harper, a scholar at AI who I've published with on other things, has done some very good work on digital identity and how do we do that consistent with democratic values that I commend for your listeners reading.
That's great. That's very helpful. You mentioned that you just published a paper with Daniel Gorfine. What's next for you? Are you writing? Are you researching? Publishing? What's What's sort of on the horizon for you? You've clearly got an incredible grasp of the relevant ideas, and you're doing great work here. So I'm just curious, like, how do you implement that, and how do you take that message out to the public?
So I'm glad you asked. I have something very exciting coming up. So the Digital Dollar Project is partnering with the Atlantic Council to host the first ever on U.S. soil conclave of central banks and private sector actors to start thinking about global standards for digital money, whether it be CBDC or stablecoin operated, and how do we do so consistent with democratic values? Our economic adversaries are striding the globe these days, looking to create interoperability standards that make digital values safe for censorship and safe for surveillance. How do we counter that? How do we do what we did in the first wave of the internet? And so this conference is going to be held in late November after Thanksgiving outside of Washington. We have representatives from most of the world's central banks, including the Bank for International Settlement, including our own Federal Reserve, but also representatives of companies that are stablecoin operators, payment providers, major banks, all of whom have a stake and an interest in hopefully developing global standards that are based upon democratic value sets. We call it an examination of the values of money. We know the value of money, but the question is, what are the values of money? And how do we make sure that the private sector and the public sector come together? In my book, which I published last year called Crypto Dad, The Fight for the Future of Money, I jokingly coined a phrase. I said that money is too important to be left to the central bankers. It's based upon a quote by a French premier after World War I, after the slaughter of World War I. He said, you know what, maybe war is too important to be left to the generals. In a similar way, I think perhaps money is too important to be left to central bankers. And I mean no disrespect to the Federal Reserve or the Bank of England. But the fact of the matter is money is as much a social construct as it is a government construct, right? Without the support of people, certainly with paper money, there's no value there, right? So if we don't believe it's valuable, we the people don't believe it's value, it has no value. And the same is going to be true about digital money. And so the private sector must be engaged in establishing what are the values of the digital money of the future. And so that's our conference in November that we're hosting. It's very important. More long-term, I'm working on a book actually with Jim Harper from the American Enterprise Institute, looking at this whole question of, we're tentatively entitled it, the values of money, that getting the values right. You know, we think about all the dangers of digital money, but let's, for a moment, just imagine the positive. Imagine the country, and let's pretend that's the United States, that rolls out a digital currency that is operationally confirmable to be non-surveilled as, you know, as an individual, as opposed to examining bulk transactions, and not cannot be censored. In a world that we're going into, think about how valuable that will be. For freedom-loving people around the world will want to hold that currency. And even if the United States is no longer the world's biggest economy, let's say China eclipses us and its currency is important, who in the free world will want that currency? Because it affirmatively has censorship and surveillance built into it. So what I'd like to see is we use the strength of our convictions to actually develop anything that touches the dollar, whether it's stablecoin or a digital dollar itself, if they are affirmatively, confirmably prevent surveillance and censorship, that will be the aspirational currency for people in the 21st century. We could actually propel the dollar forward for three more generations of reserve currency dominance because of the values it represents, as opposed to necessarily the value underlying it.
Right. I mean, soft power, right? American soft power has dwindled in many ways, but it is still extraordinary. Whether it is Taylor Swift is American soft power, the prevalence of the U.S. dollar is American soft power. I mean, there's a million different examples from all walks of life, but I'm a very strong believer in the importance of soft power and in maintaining that. I see, you know, we've talked a lot about the risk of China controlling technology. I think the prevalence of TikTok is a form of soft power. I think I'm going to get off topic here for a second, but just, you know, the number of high school and college age students who have come down very pro-Palestinian over the past 2 weeks. And then I questioned myself, there's zero chance most of these kids know anything about the history of this conflict. So where are they getting this information? The reality is their default search engine and their default source of information is TikTok. And whether it is because the algorithm is showing them information that skews them in one way, or it's a deliberate effort by the Chinese government to put divisive information in front of people, I don't know the answer to that. I can make a guess, but I don't know the answer to that. But I think there is certainly it's critical that we maintain that soft power and use the dollar to do that.
Absolutely, that's a great example, and I couldn't agree more. I'll give you another example of soft power, and this is a victory for the Chinese. The fact that they've convinced us that the only form of central bank digital currency is a surveillance tool is a victory for them. We're America. We can design a central bank digital currency that protects freedom, but they've already convinced us that their model is the benchmark and everything is basically either more surveillance or less surveillance, but it's all surveillance. There's no reason it needs to be that. When in America did we ever say a Chinese model is the model for anything, but we're saying it today in the early 21st century, and I think that's a victory for them and a loss for us. Let's do the opposite. Let's do what we did first wave of the internet and say, no. The model should be a free society model, and that should be the free society of digital currency. I'll add one more thing. I'm very disappointed in the House stablecoin bill that is moving forward because it says virtually nothing about privacy. And is that the way we are going to allow instruments based upon the dollar to be built upon a Chinese model of surveillance? So we need to fight this battle based upon our values. And the example you gave about others influencing it is something that's very troubling.
Chris, this has been a fantastic discussion. Really appreciate having you here today. Thanks so much for being here. And to all our listeners, we will be back with more soon. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Lee. It was great.